We're going to try to cover two reasons tonight. Reason number 20 and reason number 21. We're moving right along, and there's only 26 of these, so we only have five to go after this. Reason number 20 is the stories of the betrayal by Judas are not consistent. So this falls into that same category that we've been working on for the last couple reasons of discrepancies between the gospel narratives as being a major concern. And so he lists several of these discrepancies here. Did Jesus intentionally die, or did he die because he was betrayed? The name of the betrayer is highly significant. He says that's Judas. You know, Judas is actually Yehuda. You know, that's the Yehudi is Jew. So the idea being that perhaps Judas was selected as the name in order to symbolically blame the Jewish people for the death of Jesus. And indeed, that equation has been a part of historic anti-Semitism in the church. So where Judas becomes not just a character in the Gospels, but the personification of Jewish people in Christian artwork and thought and literature. That's very much true. And that is to ignore the fact that our master had two other disciples, as we learned last time, also named Yehuda. That would be Thomas and Thaddeus. And he also had a brother named Yehuda, who left us the book of Jude. Not really a fair equation to make, but he's right about this. It is the source of much hatred and anti-Semitism. He says the story is highly conflicted and lacks credibility. What is highly conflicted? I mean, he just means there's discrepancies between the Gospels. And we're going to take a look at the discrepancies that he brings up. I will remind you that as we began this section of the book that's looking at Gospel discrepancies, we kind of ran over the origin of the Gospels. How did we get our Gospels? How did these Gospels come to us? Who wrote them, etc., etc.? And I would refer you back to that teaching as a foundation for understanding and for actually becoming comfortable with Gospel discrepancies. One last point he makes here right in the introduction. Judas did not betray Jesus according to the newly discovered Gospel of Judas. And he never really brings that up any further, just throws it into the introduction there at about the time this book would have been written. That would have been fresh in the news. National Geographic released that Gospel of Judas and Gospel of Judas Special, and it was front page news. It was a big deal. Remember this about 2 years ago? No? Some of you do? Yeah? Gospel of Judas. Well, it was a Gnostic gospel, like the Nag Hammadi Gospels. We talked about Gnostic Gospels a little bit. So it has, in terms of historical reliability or credibility, it's below zero as a Gnostic Gospel. But nevertheless, an interesting thing occurred in the story, the ongoing saga of the Gospel of Judas, because the big news about Gospel of Judas was actually Judas didn't betray the Master, right? This was from the Gospel of Judas. He was actually his most devoted disciple. And so it kind of turns things on its head. Well, more recently, other scholars have taken a look at it and said, you translated that completely backwards. And National Geographic seized on the backwards translation to make it a big splashy headline. Judas doesn't betray Jesus. He's the best disciple. So in the academic world, this was considered a shameless travesty, you know, releasing this document with this faulty translation and making all this hoodoo about it. So it's an irrelevant point in any case. Okay, but we'll just stick with the real Gospels. And so he's going to give us a list of these conflicts in the story of Judas. Here we go. Number one, why did Judas betray Jesus? Two different answers coming out of the Gospels. One is the devil made him. All right? Remember? He's at the Last Seder, John 13:27, and Satan entered him. Right? Luke 22:3 is another text speaking about the satanic nature of the betrayal. So I'll go grab that Luke text. I don't know. Devil made me do it. So Luke 22:3 says, "And Satan entered into Judas, who was called Iscariot, belonging to the number of the 12." The other tradition here, being reported by Mark and Matthew, the devil was not involved. Now, I'm curious to look these passages up and see if they say the devil was not involved. So, let's see. 14:10 of Mark says, "Then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went off to the chief priests in order to betray him to them." So, that doesn't say the devil was not involved. And Matthew 27... Verse 3, "When Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse," and returned right at the top, "he felt remorse for what he had done." So, is this really a contradiction? Not according to the way that the Gospels understand demonology. The Gospel writers never portray like a hard distinction in demonology between spiritual and physical. This is something that's very difficult for people to get their minds around, because in our world, which is sort of, I think, from a Greco worldview, there's such a vast expanse between what is spiritual and what is physical, right? I know a neurologist, okay, who finds it very troubling that the Gospels connect epilepsy, epileptic seizures, and demonic possession, right? Because, I mean, it's not demonic possession. It's a short circuit in the brain. That this neurologist can show you the spot in the brain where it's short circuiting. You know, it's not demonic possession. So what's going on there? But you didn't even have to go as far as epilepsy. In the Gospels, we find somebody is deaf at one point. There's a deaf person. And the master drives out a spirit of deafness. It's like, wait a second. The guy's ears didn't work. It doesn't mean he's demon possessed. You know, he's not. It's a very real physical malady. You know, that somebody should be deaf, right? So it's a little frustrating, maybe from our perspective sometimes, to see this lack of distinction. It's almost like a superstitious worldview from our perspective. But from the Gospel writer's perspective and from the Master's perspective, it's not superstitious. It's the idea that there is everything, every physical thing is also infused with spiritual realities, and that they're not really separable. And so for that reason, we should be treating them as physical realities in the physical and spiritual realities in the spiritual. And not ever like separating and saying, no, it's one, it's the other. Because it's never one or the other, it's always both. And with everything. So anyway, that's an aside. Why is that relevant? Because of Judas. Did the devil make him do it? No, the devil didn't make him do it. Was the devil involved? Well, sure. Absolutely. Who suggested the bribe? John 13:29, you have one tradition. John presented as the corrupt treasurer of the disciples. Who suggested the bribe? Or the priesthood, Mark 14:10. See, this is not a contradiction. That's the problem.
Yeah.
That's not a contradiction whatsoever. That's making an inference off of, and then using the inference that you made to contradict the synoptic accounts. Okay, sorry about that. I didn't mean to waste your time. Number 3, did Jesus name his betrayer at the Last Supper? Mark says no. Let's have this side of the room look up the no references. Mark 14:18 and Luke 22:21-22. We'll have this side of the room look up the yes references. And the yes references are John 13:26 and Matthew 26:25. All right, you guys, you know people ready?
Yeah, I know.
Did Jesus name his betrayer at the Last Supper? Go ahead.
Well, he didn't come up with a name.
No, he didn't come up with the name?
No.
All right, any inferences there or anything?
Not in Mark.
Okay, all right. Okay. How about Luke?
He doesn't say whose hand.
Oh, okay, he didn't say whose hand. Okay, how about you guys over here, the yes people? What is John, give us John 13:26. Okay. And Matthew 26:25.
Right. Then Judas, which betrayed him, answered and said, Master, is it I? He said unto him, Thou hast said.
He says to Judas, Thou hast said, which is a little ambiguous.
No.
Is there anyone who finds a contradiction here?
No.
Okay. Not doing real well. Asher, Norman, on convincing us. But here's something more significant, okay? How did Judas die? Okay? So we'll have this side, Yamini, to look up Acts 1:15-22. All right, Acts 1:15-22, and we'll have this side look up Matthew 27:5, because there is a real difference here. Yes, and while you're looking up, I thought just for fun, you're looking up Matthew 27:5, and I thought just for fun, as long as we're looking at some discrepancies, I thought I'd throw in a third, and bring up another one from Papias. All right. Give us the Acts one. The Acts version of the story.
Okay.
By Luke. Who's going to read it?
Now this man acquired a field with the reward of his wickedness, and falling headlong, he burst open in the middle, and all his bowels gushed out, and became known to all the inhabitants of Jerusalem. So that the field was called in their own language, Akeldama, that is, field of blood.
So what happened there? He bought a field, and then
he fell headlong, and his bowels split open.
So he took a fall.
Yeah.
Out in his field.
In the middle of a field, not on a rocky cliff.
Right. Okay. And this he bought the field with the money. You got that?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. Over here, how did he die?
Five, hurling the pieces of silver into the sanctuary, he left. Then he went off and hanged himself.
So he hung himself over here. So one says he tripped and fell.
No. It didn't say he tripped.
Well, I added that part. Maybe it was the other 11 disciples. He fell.
Or the priests.
Well, maybe they were broken, then he fell.
You have to burst your guts out.
Sure.
He's up there long enough to fell.
I imagine.
I've heard that theory of harmonizing them by saying, then the rope broke. And, you know, so that's maybe that's how it, and he fell. When the rope broke. I don't know.
Where the tree was that he hung himself on.
Well, but that's interesting because Matthew didn't put it in the field there.
No.
No, so I think it's fair to say that you do have a discrepancy here. Maybe it can be reconciled. Probably it can be harmonized. And we certainly can do that through some creative ways. We just have a discrepancy about how he died. So I'll throw in one more, I promised you.
Okay.
I'd throw in one more. This is from Papias, and so this comes from oral traditions of the apostolic community, allegedly. Judas walked about in this world as a great example of impiety. For his body, having swollen to such an extent that he could not pass where a chariot could easily pass. No wonder the rope broke, right? He was crushed by the chariot so that his bowels gushed out.
You have another interpretation?
I like that question, though. What chariot? He was crushed by the chariot. What chariot? Because the chariot is, in early Judaism, the chariot is a reference to the throne of God. That's a name for the throne of God.
Oh.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. The Merkava from Ezekiel 1. Yes.
By Dr. John Lightfoot.
Oh, Dr. John Lightfoot. We want to hear what he...
So he says, He writes, the devil immediately after Judas had cast back his money into the temple, caught him up into the air, strangled him, threw him headlong, and dashed him in pieces on the ground. That, end quotes. He refers to Tobit 3:8 and adds that this was known to all the dwellers at Jerusalem, argues that it was no common and ordinary event, and must be something more than hanging himself, which was an accident not so very unusual in that nation. This requires that Matthew 27:5 be read, he was hanged or strangled, instead of he hanged himself.
So John Lightfoot, with some sort of strange reference to Tobit, which is about, the reference to Tobit would be about an evil spirit that strangles, is suggesting that what really happened was not that he hung himself, but the devil strangled him, or hung him, and threw him around and split him open. It gets a little bit more difficult even yet, because we can ask, was he repentant? That's irrelevant, we'll skip that one. Was he repentant? We'll go to, where did he die? We already saw this. Acts says field of blood, Matthew doesn't say. So not a discrepancy. The location is not a discrepancy. Number 7, who bought the field of blood? Now this is a problem, okay? So we already learned from Acts that Judas bought the field with the money that he made on the betrayal, right? But if we go to Matthew 27, we'll find that on the contrary, he doesn't have that money anymore.
No, he's thrown it away.
That's right. Matthew 27, verse 7. Well, this is after he's already thrown it away. So he throws it away. And then it says, the chief priest took the pieces of silver and said, it's not lawful for them to be put into the temple treasury since it is the price of blood. And they conferred together with the money. And with the money, they bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood, as it is to this day. Does it say they buried him there? I always assume they buried him there, but it doesn't seem to say that here in Matthew. But I always assume that he was buried in this field. Mm-hmm. That his tomb was in this field. It is a burial place. Did no one else ever assume that?
I did. Yeah. I assumed he was. Yeah.
Okay. So at least I'm not alone in the assumption. Well, I just assume.
In a way, you say Judas bought it.
Yeah, you could say he bought the field.
It's his money.
So we can harmonize these narratives, and there's a couple different ways that you're all suggesting, and I could suggest as well, and I think we should harmonize the narratives. But to step back from that for a second, we do see that there are two different traditions, although closely related here. On the one hand, the money is given back to the priesthood or thrown back to the priesthood. Then Judas hangs himself or gets hung. Then the priesthood uses the money to buy the field. On the other hand, Judas uses the money. He doesn't give it back. He uses the money to buy the field himself, and he dies in the field. So there are two different strands of tradition here. What's sure is there is a connection with a bribe price of 30 pieces of silver or some amount of silver that Judas was paid, and that somehow this money is connected with the purchase of a field that's called the field of blood that then carries an association in apostolic tradition with Judas thereafter. So that's what we can, based upon the discrepancy, we can at least say they agree on this much, right? Mm-hmm. Now, as you know, as I've said before, I am all for harmonizing. That's all the sages did all the time, every day. You know, that's what Judaism really is harmonizing disparate religious texts, I think. That's a big chunk of it. So I'm good with that. But I just as long as we understand, he's got a point on us here. Well, yes. That if all four Gospels had exactly the same story, we'd only need one. From my perspective, the reliability of the Gospels is heightened by their discrepancies, not because, well, that just shows that different people wrote them, but here's why I think it heightens their reliability. because it shows that the church didn't redact them. That the early church fathers, the church in transmitting these gospels, transmitted them with all of their incongruities intact. And so to me, that raises the credibility of the gospel narratives as we've received them. That's it for his list of reasons, but there's one more that he gives here, and that is the 30 pieces of silver. So look here in Matthew 27. This is very interesting, I think. This is the thing I was looking forward to thinking about with you. Matthew 27, beginning in verse 7, as we drop into this story again, it says, "The priests conferred together with the money they bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel, and they gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me." Jesus stood before... Okay, so that's it. Okay, so great. Here's the problem. If we go and look this passage up in Jeremiah, which is Jeremiah 32, I just happened to have been working on this about 2 weeks ago, Jeremiah 32, in connection with a...
Chapter 32, verse 2.
Chapter 32. This is... A passage that actually shows up as a Haftarah in the reading cycle. I believe it was for Behar or Bechukotai, but I'm thinking it was for Behar. And it's where Jeremiah's cousin comes and, or nephew, or cousin, or I think it's a cousin, comes and says to him, "I want you to redeem the field, my field at Anatot." And Jeremiah is like, the city is under siege, and in about, oh, you know, 1 week, there's going to be no kingdom of Judah, no land deeds, nobody's going to own anything, everything's going to be owned by Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar, and everybody's going to be deported. And Jeremiah knows this because he's been prophesying this for a long time. But even as his cousin is saying, "I'd like you to redeem this," you know, the battering rams are already hitting the walls. It tells us that the siege ramps were complete. So it's a little ridiculous of a request. It's like, you know, it's like, "And now how much would you pay?" You know? But the Lord tells Jeremiah, "No, do it. Buy it and pay full price, because fields and vineyards will again be sold in Judah." And he has him record it. You know, the story, puts it in a scroll. He seals it, preserves it for posterity by preserving the scroll in an earthenware jar. All right, so that's the passage where we're buying a field. But the field, if you start reading in verse 6, right? Jeremiah said, "The word of the Lord came to me, saying, Behold, Hanamel the son of Shallum, your uncle, is coming to you, saying, Buy for yourself my field, which is at Anatot, for you have the right of redemption to buy it. Then Hanamel, my uncle's son, came to me in the court of the guard according to the word of the Lord and said to me, Buy my field, please," etc. So I bought the field that was at Anatot from Hanamel, my uncle's son, and I weighed out the silver for him, 17 shekels of silver. I signed and sealed the deed. So, 17 shekels of silver. He buys the field. So, Asher Norman says, how does that fulfill the prophecy? 30 shekels of silver, they buy a field. Jeremiah buys a totally different field that's not even called the field of the potter for 17 shekels of silver. But this is one case in which we managed to trick Asher Norman by slipping in the name Jeremiah when we really meant Zechariah. So here's the real prophecy that Matthew is referring to. If you turn over to Zechariah chapter 11, come over to Zechariah 11. We'll start in verse 11. So it was broken on that day, and thus the afflicted of the flock who were watching me realized that it was the word of the Lord. I said to them, if it is good in your sight, give me my wages, but if not, never mind. So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver as my wages, or as my price, you might say. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. So I threw the 30 shekels of silver and threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. What do you think? Zechariah or Jeremiah?
In Matthew it says Jeremiah.
It says Jeremiah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So, what do you do with this? Well, I would say this is a situation where we can definitely be certain that Matthew really meant Zechariah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few attempts to salvage at this point. There's a few attempts. One, I'll just run through them as they pop into my head. One is that there is an apocryphal version of Jeremiah or some other version of Jeremiah that we don't know about that also had a potter's field being bought for 30 shekels or something like that. That doesn't work so well. Another possible explanation is that Matthew was referring to a collection, some orderings of the Tanakh, the collection of the whole books of the prophets, Nevi'im, began with Jeremiah instead of Isaiah, apparently. Therefore, to say Jeremiah, you might be just using it to mean the prophets. I don't think so, because he's never done that at any other place. No, you know, this would be the only instance that we ever know of. Another possible save is that there was some kind of collection, conglomeration of prophetic texts that spoke, that the early believers used, that they had seen fulfilled in by Messiah, and that these two texts were married. This text from Jeremiah and the text from Zechariah were married together. Now this is very likely, because if this is the same thing that we see throughout the Midrash, is that there will be one text married to another text, and so, you know, things that are really talking about quite different things in their native context are taken out of context and joined to make a new thing. That's a normal Jewish kind of method of interpretation. So according to that, following that reasoning, what Matthew has done here, he's worked out a midrash with Zechariah and Jeremiah, taking these two passages, joining them, but he only mentions Jeremiah. So there you go. Anyway, it's a problem. Yes. Or maybe Matthew's early scribes made a mistake.
Okay.
You know, it's very possible that, and this is perhaps the most likely, is that you're an early generation of scribe. Most likely, I would say, Matthew did not even give a reference. He said, happened to fulfill what was written in the prophets, saying, and then he kind of like quotes it. And a scribe is going to want to supply that name to bring it a little closer to home. And he's going to hear that potter's field. And where's his mind going to go? Jeremiah. Because Jeremiah is the guy who's like, goes out to the potter's house, and God's like, take a look at how the potter makes his pot. You know that whole thing?
Yeah.
Right. So his mind goes to Jeremiah, and then there's the field. His mind goes to Jeremiah. And so he's like, as Jeremiah the prophet, but it's Zechariah.
Yeah.
Anyway, isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
So what's his conclusion? Asher Norman says, well, the devil's in the details. There are significant contradictions in the Gospel of Judas stories, and this undermines the credibility. I would say there are some contradictions. I'd say we found maybe two contradictions out of the eight or so that he listed, that there are two legitimate contradictions. Even these can be reconciled. And even these have a commonality of agreement between them, so that you could say they agree on more than they disagree on. So does it undermine their credibility? A little bit, in some ways, but in other ways, no. Asher Norman does not have the critical eye focused right now on his own religious text. But yes, according, that's the principle that the guys at FFOZ and I always call it equal weights and measures. Because we'll always, this always happens where people start to lose faith in Messiah, and they'll start, and they'll come and they'll start pointing these things out. You know, there's this, and did you know the gospel's this, and that sort of thing. And they're like getting all twisted up over this stuff. And then so we always say, well, you know, are you applying the same standard to the Talmud? Are you applying the same standard to the Tanakh? And they never are. And they're never willing to do that. Reason number 21. The Jewish trial of Jesus lacks credibility. All right. First thing is, according to John, if we just start in the Gospel of John, there was no Jewish trial. And here's how he's going to bring us to the Gospel of John. And chapter 18, we were just there a little bit ago, weren't we? Verse 13, yeah, 18, verse 13. The Romans led him to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now, Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people. And so Simon follows Jesus, and so is another disciple. And now that disciple is known to the high priest. He entered into the court of the high priest. Okay, so what's going on? Oh, I see. His point is that this is not a trial. He's like brought to someone's house. And in fact, we'll see that's exactly the case. He's brought to Hananiah, Annas there, is like the godfather of the mafia of this priesthood, of the current priesthood to which Caiaphas belongs. Caiaphas is married to his daughter or something like that. And so Caiaphas is high priest on his father-in-law's dime. And so Jesus is arrested, he's brought to this guy's house, and then he's brought over to Caiaphas' house, because we find him in Caiaphas' house in the Synoptic Gospels. That makes sense. He's brought over here, he's brought over here. But the point is that these trials that we read about, that you know Jesus goes on trial, they aren't in a court. They're in someone's house. So this is it's not really a trial. And his point is that, yeah, verse 24, so Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas after questioning him. Right. But right now he's just staying with the John narrative. It says in verse 19, though, the high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Mm-hmm. Why do you question me? And you have Peter standing in the courtyard and so on. All right, so that's about all you get from John. You don't get the details of the trial, what was going on. You don't get the details of the interrogation. Okay, so Matthew and Mark describe a Jewish trial with a blasphemy verdict. Let's look at the Mark version, I suppose. Mark chapter 14. They led Jesus away to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes gathered together. Peter had followed him at a distance. In verse 55, the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain testimony against Jesus to put him to death. They're not finding any. For many were giving false testimony against him, but their testimony was not consistent. Some stood up and began to give false testimony against him, saying, "We have heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands.'" Not even in this respect was their testimony consistent. The high priest stood up and came forward and questioned Jesus, saying, "Do you not answer? What is it these men are testifying?" But he kept silent and did not answer. Again, the high priest questioned him, saying to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" And Jesus said, "I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Tearing his clothes, the high priest said, "What further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard blasphemy. How does it seem to you?" And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. All right, there you go. Here's a very interesting thing. The high priest, he won't answer any questions. The master doesn't answer any questions, right? And then it says he asks him again, and he answers. What's the difference? Why did he not answer, and then he did answer? The difference is, in Matthew 27:63, you read, Jesus kept silent, and the high priest said to him, I adjure you by the living God that you tell us. So he puts him under oath, so to speak. He charges him in the name of God. In the Torah it says that if a person is charged to testify like this, and he does not, he will become guilty. And so he had no choice when he charged him like that to answer the question. Interesting item. Anyway, Asher Norman does a fairly good job of critiquing this narrative. I think I actually have in Torah Club at some point a critique as well of the trial that points out all the problems. The problems come down to this. We don't really need to go through all of these, and most of these turned out to be bum references anyway. I was just looking them up before the class. First of all, claiming to be Christ is not blasphemy, right? Claiming to be the Messiah. That's not blasphemy. Anybody could claim to be the Messiah. You don't get crucified for it. You don't get stoned or something. It's not blasphemous to say, I'm the Messiah. It's like, okay, great. Why don't you redeem us, Mr. Messiah guy? Okay, great. So that's not blasphemy. And so he says, that doesn't make sense. Claiming to be the Christ was a claim to the throne of King David. It was a claim of kingship, not godship, and was sedition under Roman law. Jesus was tried and convicted for claiming kingship, for sedition, and for telling Jews not to pay Roman taxes. So this is his theory. It's just a theory. Claiming to be the Son of God did not constitute blasphemy in Jewish law. Blasphemy involves cursing God's name. And Son of God is a Davidic title. So where's the blasphemy, he's asking. All right. First of all, it doesn't have to be a blasphemy charge by Talmudic law. The Gospels criticize the Pharisees for being overly strict in their observance of the law, Asher Norman says. So, Pharisees, right? But then he goes on to say, if you follow Pharisaic law, and note that his references are pretty much all bad on here, but these are all true things. It's just that he's given us bad references, bad citations. Okay, the Sanhedrin cannot try a capital case outside of the temple. That's true. To try a capital case, they were supposed to be on the Temple Mount. This is derived from Deuteronomy 16. Here they're in Caiaphas' house. You can't do a capital case in Caiaphas' house, according to Pharisaic law. According to Pharisaic law, criminal trials could be conducted only in daylight, and they were supposed to be over before nightfall. I don't know why, but that's true, according to Pharisaic law. According to Pharisaic law, no self-incrimination was allowed. Only two witnesses, the testimony of two or more witnesses could be accepted, but nobody could incriminate himself and say, yeah, I did it, I killed him. That wouldn't be accepted. And here we have this self-incriminating thing, according to Pharisaic law. There's other things. For example, according to Jewish law in general, but certainly the Pharisaic law, you can't do this on a Sabbath, even on the eve of a Sabbath, which this would have been. So there's other things too. I just can't remember them all. So how do you deal with this? On the one hand, Jewish sources say a trial would have never gone down like this. But on the other hand, we've got, this trial going down like this. How do you deal with this? Here's how I would suggest dealing with this. These aren't Pharisees. They're not Pharisees. They're Sadducees. And they don't give a rip for Pharisaic law. They don't care whatsoever about Pharisaic tradition. They're Sadducees, and they've excluded the Pharisees, and in fact, that's probably why they're meeting in the middle of the night. That's probably why the trial is taking place over in Caiaphas's house. Caiaphas is the head of the Sadducean party. So, yeah, where is Joseph of Arimathea's vote here? Where's Nicodemus's vote? Where's wise Gamaliel? They're at home. You know, they're not part of this trial. This is a secret deal. This is what's called a kangaroo court. It's not a legitimate trial. And so it's not an act of the Sanhedrin. Now, it does say the whole council. But there's different ways to understand whole council. It could be the whole council of Sadducees. The whole council of the Sadducees. Well, if they're obeying their own rules, they would be preparing for the festival and would have, more likely, asleep at this hour. You know, because anyway, the point is that you can't measure this trial according to Pharisaic law because the Pharisees weren't involved. The whole council altogether would have been 72. Josephus points out all sorts of shenanigans by these guys. Corruption up to the hilt. Yep, absolutely. Well, at a certain point, the Sadducean priesthood is so corrupt that they're assassinating people, you know. Right, and Josephus points out that it's these people, these are the same people that put James to death, the brother of the master, against the outcry of the Pharisees. The Pharisees or the Sadducees?
The Sadducees.
Yeah, the Sadducees wanted James silenced.
Yeah. Wasn't he just stirring up just too much commotion?
Yeah, and he's leader of a very popular sect that believed in the resurrection of the dead, I think was a big problem. Right. So then what do you do with that? There's this. I forgot to mention. The term Sanhedrin, we just use that kind of like Sanhedrin. Bang, Sanhedrin. There's one Sanhedrin. There's not. Sanhedrin is just, it's a Greek word for council, right? And so there's several councils. And even like here in the Tosefta, I was just reading, I think, it was somewhere over here, and it was in Tractate Sanhedrin. I was reading that there are these different levels, you know, there's these different courts. Every one of these courts was a greater Sanhedrin or a lesser Sanhedrin and that sort of thing. So it's not a monolithic term for just one body of legislators. One more point on here. The Jews could skip down to where it says the Jews could execute criminals. What's his point? Well, why does the council bring Jesus to Pilate after they've already determined a guilty verdict? No, because they said they don't have political power to put anyone to death. Because Pilate says, you take him and put him to death. And they say, hey, we don't have the authority to put anyone to death. Right? So that's why the charges change. When they bring him to Pilate, they don't say, he's a blasphemer. They say, he claimed to be king. Mm-hmm. And so they move it, it's moving to a political, secular court, so they come up with a secular charge to stick on him, right? Okay, so then they say, well, we don't have the authority to put anyone to death. Asher Norman says, they certainly did have the authority to put people to death. This is a discrepancy in the Gospels. And he says, and you can prove it from the New Testament itself. For example, Stephen. They apparently had the authority to put him to death, right? Or what about the woman caught in adultery? They say, she was caught in the very act. Now Moses says we should put her to death. What do you say? Or, for example, Paul, when he's on trial, he wants to get out of Jerusalem so the Sanhedrin won't put him to death. Right? In Acts 26:10, Paul mentions that he was putting many people to death, or working with the Sanhedrin to put people to death. Right? Then he mentions John the Baptist and James the brother of John. Stephen is an act of the Sanhedrin. That's for real. But the woman caught in adultery does not imply that there actually was any sort of power of court. It was, in fact, that was the point of the question, I think. Was like, Moses says we're supposed to stone her, but what do you say? Because then it's a trap. Because it's like, if you say, well, we should stone her, oh, that's rebellion against Rome. You know, because Rome won't let us stone her. So that's what's going on there. And if he says, well, we shouldn't stone her, then they're like, oh, breaking the Torah. Paul's change of venue is quite a bit later. So is the stoning of Stephen. John the Baptist is not by the Sanhedrin. That's by the Roman appointed of Herod. Same with James as Agrippa. That's Agrippa. That's not the Sanhedrin. Josephus doesn't give us any specific examples. So Stephen is the only real problem there. But his point is well taken. How do we know, where does this idea, that the Sanhedrin didn't have the authority to put people to death come from? Where does this even come from? And so he concocts an idea to claim that actually the Romans did put him to death, and that's how he died. But Matthew and Mark made up this whole thing about the Jewish people, or the Jewish council turning him over to the Romans in this whole mock trial in order to blame the Jewish people for the death of Jesus. Here's what I want to give you. This is a page from the Talmud. I'll just read this to you really quickly. And this is Avodah Zarah 8b. 40 years before the Second Temple was destroyed, so you do the math, 30 Common Era, this is the year that the Master died. 40 years before the Second Temple was destroyed, the Great Sanhedrin exiled itself from its seat in the Temple courtyard and took its seat in the building on the Temple called Chanut. They left, that's one theory, that Chanut is another chamber on the Temple Mount, but it's not necessarily. Took its seat in Chanut is all it really says. So they say, in regard to what law is this significant? And Yitzhak Bar Avdimi says, it means to say that they could not judge cases involving penalty law anymore. And then it goes on for quite a bit. Penalty law, what are we talking about? Penalty law, is that what we're really talking about? And after some discussion about penalty law and then some stories about it and that sort of thing, it goes on to say, Rav Nachman Bar Yitzhak said, don't say it was penalty law, the laws of fines and fees. That's not the issue. Rather, they did not try capital cases. They did not. So here we are. It's the year the Master dies. It says they did not try capital cases the year that Yeshua dies. The Gemara asks, what was their reason for ceasing to try capital cases? And it answers, since they saw there were so many murderers, they were unable to judge them all. So they said, it's better that we exile ourselves from our place to another place so that they will not all be liable. Okay, that's probably not exactly how it happened. Probably exactly how it happened is that Pilate, who had jurisdiction over the region, said, you know what? You don't get to put people to death without our permission anymore. Out of protest, they probably removed themselves from the chamber of hewn stone in the temple. We're not allowed to put anyone to death. The remarkable thing is that you come down to the exact year. Now, these sorts of things, these sorts of political arrangements changed all the time. So it's very possible that within a year after that, power had reverted to the Sanhedrin, and they could have been back in the chamber of hewn stone issuing death sentences. So, is that a problem? No. That's not a problem. So I put on here, consider Avodah Zarah 8b. Conclusion. Asher Norman says it wasn't blasphemy. It's true, it wasn't blasphemy. But it could have been construed into blasphemy. The Gospels claim the trial took place outside the temple at night, on the Sabbath, and a festival. None of which would have happened by Pharisaic law. But it wasn't Pharisees. Jews could execute criminals. We just looked that up. They couldn't in the year that the Master died. Mark and Matthew's account of a Jewish trial appears to be a fabrication designed to switch the blame for Jesus' death from the Romans to the Jews. Nope. In fact, I think it's just the opposite.
It's like they handed him over to Pilate so they couldn't be blamed for his death because the people would have been...
Right. Remember how they were saying not during the festival, not during the festival, because there's so many people around. Well, they end up doing it during the festival. But they get the Romans to do it for them. So it's not this. Okay, it's not our fault. That's it. That's it. That's 20 and 21, which were not difficult. Those were easy ones. We only had one real problem, and that was that little discrepancy with Judas, right? At the field of blood.